It's nice to see you again. It's nice to be here with you again. And it's actually nice to be able to stand here with you. Those that don't know, this year has been an interesting year for our family. It's been a year of surgeries. And I'm just recovering from my second surgery. I've had both knees replaced this year. So I'm thankful to be standing here literally with you. This year, I've been teaching a home Bible study, and we've been, at the request of the families that have been in the study, that we've been studying the book of John, which was an unbelievable blessing for all of us this year. And I've been really convicted of all the things that I'm kind of relearning. I think sometimes you take things for granted, and it's you need to get back to the basics and think through these things over and over again. And it's amazing how many times you see more and more, and the Lord speaks to you as you go through some of these things. So I'm going to discuss with you today from the book of John, and we're particularly in chapter 7 and 8, which is one of the that's actually the area that we left off with so far this year. That's as far as we were able to get with all the discussion and so on. And quite frankly, I was so pleased that that there was so much to learn from each of the people that were involved in the study, and not just from the leader. So just to give you a background of a review, I guess, of the book of John. We know the author was John, the apostle, the same one who wrote the book of Revelation, son of Zebedee, brother of James, the apostle. And the neat thing about the book of John is that it's a different gospel than the others. It's less concerned with the chronological events that have happened in Jesus' time, but on earth, but he was more concerned about what Jesus' actions, not as so much about what Jesus' actions were, as much as what they said about Jesus. And he likes to pull you below the surface and get deeper into the more spiritual aspects of Christ's coming. And the whole book is based on proving that Christ was the Messiah and is the Messiah, and that Jesus being God and the Son of God is such a unique thing, and such a and Christ is such a unique being. And this book is amazing because John was able to record so many of Christ's monologues, theological monologues, very precisely. John was also very much into the way God's number seven worked. There's so many sevens in this book. It's kind of interesting to see how the seven gets interweaved in things so often. Interestingly enough, we're also looking at chapter 7 today, but that's really nothing to do with it. He records, of all the miracles that Christ did, he only records seven of those miracles in the book, and he calls them signs. And he really concentrates on how these signs are physical expressions or representations of some of the deep spiritual truths that Christ is teaching, and they have connection, which I think is amazing, that the connection goes right through from the Old Testament to the time when Christ was there, and they have such meaning for us today. And I think that's just part of God's beautiful plan for us. And he intertwines this seven in many ways. And there's also, in the book, if you look through, there's the theological monologues that that Christ said about himself. He calls himself I Am, and when he talks about I Am, it's seven times. There's seven monologues of that in the book. So it's kind of interesting to see the way these some of these things work out. And John happens to give probably the most detailed description of the Last Supper when you get to chapter 13 in the book, and from there it's quite detailed, more than the other Gospels. He also teaches how Jesus sets a perfect standard for us to strive towards and to keep us on the proper spiritual track. John's events all have historical and real roots from the Old Testament, and he relates them in such a way as to show the harmony that exists with Christ at the helm. And it's an important thing for me, especially because I think that some of the more distressing things that I see today are in what I think is a very broken world. I mean, besides my body being broken and needing healing, there's so many other broken things today. And one of the things, I do a lot of weddings, marriages, and it amazes me how much brokenness there is, and it carries on, you know, when you with the broken families and broken marriages that cause difficulties for people, not only in this generation but in the next generations to come. And it seems that we're in a really strange and difficult predicament today in the world that we live in. And John's inspired accounts of Jesus, as I said, they look beneath the surface in such deep spiritual realities to emphasize what I believe this book emphasizes is his grace and his truth in balance. And grace being his deep love and understanding, his compassion, his forgiveness, and the truth being the reality of sin and evil in the world, in ourselves. And that without God's truth, without the laws, without the teachings and his standards, we're left with a pretty broken world. And just to carry on with what we would like to do today, I would like to read as much as we can of the book and let it speak for itself, and not so much speak for it, but let it do the speaking, because John's inspired word is very deep, and I think that it's important for us to read it and listen to it. Now, I chose to use this book, is the new, it's a New English Translation, and I don't mean to offend anybody with it, but I find that if I try different versions every time, I kind of get a different perspective on things. So please forgive me if you don't like that version particularly, but this is just kind of the one I've brought to camp with me this week and I'm working on. So let's all turn to John chapter 7, if we could please, and let's look at this particular passage. And again, I have to give you a little more background, because in this particular passage in John chapter 7, it's a time when the Jewish people were celebrating the Feast of Shelters, or Feast of Booths, or Tabernacles. And it's not one of those feasts that you really relate to very much anymore. You don't hear about it too much anymore, but it was an important feast at the time. According to Deuteronomy 6 and 16, it happens to be the seventh feast that the Lord commanded Israel to observe. As a matter of fact, God commanded that every male should attend this annual feast. So it was a very important feast. It was also the third of three feasts that the Lord commanded that all Jews had to attend together every year. The other two were the Feast of the Unleavened Bread and the Passover, and the second feast was the Feast of Weeks, which came in midsummer, 7 weeks after the first cutting or harvest. But the Feast of Booths or Tents was an interesting feast, because it usually was celebrated late in September or mid-October, and can very loosely be compared to our Thanksgiving feast, in that it was a celebration of God's provision for God's people, and especially during the current year's harvest. But for the Jews, it also represents God's miraculous provision for and protection during the 40 years when Moses was leading them in the wilderness. And the start of the feast is usually 5 days after the Day of Atonement feast. It always starts on the Sabbath day, and it runs for 6 days, and then it ends on the Sabbath day. And with the influx of people coming to Jerusalem at that time, I can only you know, you got to try and imagine what it must have been like, because there are thousands and thousands of people, and that's why they call this the Feast of Tents, because thousands and thousands of people came, and they brought these little shelters with them, and there would be like Tent City. Just as far as the eye could see would be all these tents, and all these people came for this whole week to celebrate this feast. And like all feasts, it was instituted by God as a way of reminding the Israelites in each generation of the deliverance of God for their people in Egypt, from Egypt. And of course, the feasts are also significant in that they foreshadow the work and actions of the coming Messiah, which is unique about today's reading. And this section of Scripture in John 7 is another such time when Jesus' public ministry took place in conjunction with a holy feast. And I think that that was part of God's plan. As a sidebar as well, it's interesting to note that there are many scholars who believe that it was likely during the Feast of Tabernacles that Jesus was actually born. While we celebrate Christ's birth on December 25th, most scholars acknowledge that the tradition was begun in the 4th century AD by the Roman Catholic Church, and the exact day of Jesus' birth is unknown. But some of the evidence that Jesus might have been born earlier in the year during the Feast of Tabernacles includes the fact that it would be unlikely for shepherds to be in their fields in the middle of December. It's more likely that it would have happened earlier in the fall. And there's a strong possibility that Jesus was born at the time of the Feast of Tabernacles. And it's also seen in the words John wrote in John 1:14, "And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory, and the glory of the only begotten Son of the Father, full of grace and truth." And the word John chose to speak of Jesus dwelling among us is the word tabernacle. He tabernacled amongst us, which simply means to dwell in a tent. So knowing the background, I'll ask you if you could read with me, starting at the first verse of John chapter 7. It says, "After this, Jesus traveled around Galilee. He wanted to stay out of Judea, where the Jewish leaders were plotting his death. But soon it was time for the Jewish festival of shelters. And Jesus' brothers said to him, 'Leave here and go to Judea, where your followers can see your miracles. You can't become famous if you hide like this. If you can do such wonderful things, show yourself to the world.'" And verse 5 says, "For even his brothers didn't believe in him." I imagine that was probably quite a difficult thing for Jesus to deal with, that his own brothers, because I'm sure in this context these brothers were not just disciples, they were his actual blood brothers, and after all that had happened in his life and the fact that they lived with him and they still didn't believe in him. It just brings perspective to today, as many people who just refuse to believe in the Lord. But Jesus replied, "Now is not the right time for me to go, but you can go anytime. The world can't hate you, but it does hate me because I accuse it of doing evil. You go on. I'm not going to this festival because my time has not yet come." And after saying these things, Jesus remained in Galilee. It's an interesting little caption here. He says that the world doesn't hate you. It hates me because I accuse it of doing evil. Now, in context, you know, Christ didn't go around judging people, did he? And yet you have to wonder what he was meaning when he said that. But when you think of it in terms that we know of, you know, the people that are popular and seem to get along most with other people are not necessarily Christian living people, are they? They're people who are easily persuaded to do what the world wants you to do and get along very well with the world. But he says it hates him because he accuses it of doing evil. And I think what he's trying to say here is that Christ, because he never sinned, he was the personification of a standard that few of us, if any of us, could ever try to live up to. And his teachings were not just teachings of goodness and grace and forgiveness. He also taught that the stark reality that there is sin in the world and we are sinners. And people didn't like to hear that. That wasn't the message they liked to hear. They liked to hear the good part. They wanted to see a Messiah that was coming to uplift them, not to make them deal with their inner selves and the parts of them that they like to keep hidden. But even so, and it's interesting too, he says that he was not ruined because his time had not yet come. And in the book of John, many of these little sayings repeat themselves. And the first time you see that is in the beginning of the book when Christ was at the wedding feast and his mother said for him to do something to make the water into wine. And she knew he could, but he said to her, you know, woman, my time has not yet come. Yet he went ahead and he did it. And it's kind of an interesting mirrored image of that particular time, because in this case, he did go. His brothers went first. He didn't go, but he did go. So, I don't think he was lying to them. I know he wasn't lying to them, but I think we have to understand the context of the way the language works in that time. And his time had not yet come. He was following his father's instructions on how he was to go. And his brother's intent for him to go was to go and create miracles and to be the center of attraction and to make himself known to everybody so that, in their words, that he could become famous. And that wasn't Christ's intent at all. And his intent was to obey his father. So after his brothers left the festival, in verse 10, left for the festival, Jesus also went, though secretly, staying out of public view. Of course, there were people who wanted to kill him, and he did have to be very careful when he traveled. The Jewish leaders tried to find him at the festival and kept asking if anyone had seen him. So they were actually looking for him. There was a lot of grumbling about him among the crowds. Some argued he's a good man, but others said he's nothing but a fraud who deceives the people. But no one had the courage to speak favorably about him in public, for they were afraid of getting in trouble with the Jewish leaders. And why was Christ in trouble with the Jewish leaders? Many scriptures talk about him being in trouble with them because he healed a man on the Sabbath. And you're not supposed to work on the Sabbath. Well, not only did he heal this man, he told him to pick up his cot and walk with it. So it was almost like he was emphasizing to the people that that wasn't the way the law should be interpreted. And he brought that to light. And the worst part of it all, even after all of that, where the Pharisees felt pretty insulted by his view of it, he told the man that he forgave him his sins. And that really annoyed the scribes and the Pharisees, and they were after him with a fury after that, because he ascribed himself to be God. But in the first part of the book of John covers that with the pre-existence of Christ. He talks about Christ being the Word, and the Word was with God at the beginning, and the Word was there when he was created. And Christ being the Word and the Word being the truth are the same thing. And so Christ was fulfilling the prophecy. He was fulfilling the plan of God. And the scribes and Pharisees who studied God's Word couldn't see it. And it's funny how people today who are so learned, who have a tremendous amount of education, just can't see it. I worked for 25 years at a university, and I am amazed at how intelligent some people can be, how hard they can work at it, and yet how few of them would be willing to submit to a higher power. It's a difficult thing to respect people for their intelligence and yet to see their foolishness at the same time. And that's what kind of people we are today, and that's the kind of world that we live in. Then it says that no one had the courage to speak favorably about him in public. And that's interesting, because doesn't that remind you of about today? I mean, nobody seems to have the courage to speak out for Christianity in public today. And the things of Christ of Christianity seem to have fallen so far back in the eyes of the world and in the eyes of the powers to be that it's not very popular to be a Christian today. And it's very, and just like in those days, when the laws had changed so much and they've added to them so much, they've humanized them so much, and then the Roman government came in and created more laws, and so there were laws about laws, and we're pretty much in that same state today. You know, here we are, the Bible tells us we should obey the laws, and yet, you know, there's a law out there that says you can kill babies. And there's a law out there that says we can't discriminate against people who sin. And Christ came, he didn't come to judge at that time. He came to love, heal, and forgive. And he's telling us to do that as well. And we're caught in a lot of the same situation that Christ was back in that time. So it's a good thing to see how he acts and the things that he says, to see who he is through his actions, to help us to know how we should live. In verse 14, it says, "Then midway through the festival, Jesus went to the temple and began to teach. The people were surprised when they heard him. 'How does he know so much when he hasn't been trained?' they asked. So Jesus told them, 'My message is not my own. It comes from God who sent me. Anyone who wants to do the will of God will know whether my teaching is from God or is merely my own. Those who speak for themselves mock glory only for themselves, but a person who seeks to honor the one who sent him speaks truth, not lies. Moses gave you the law, but none of you obeys it. In fact, you are trying to kill me.' The crowd replied, 'You're demon-possessed. Who's trying to kill you?' And Jesus replied, 'I did one miracle on the Sabbath, and you were amazed. But you work on the Sabbath, too, when you obey Moses' law of circumcision.' So actually, this tradition of circumcision began with the patriarchs long before the law of Moses. For if the correct time for circumcising your own son falls on the Sabbath, you go ahead and do it, so as not to break the law of Moses. So why should you be angry with me for healing a man on the Sabbath?' And he says to them, and I think this is one of the most interesting lines in this passage, in verse 24, 'Look beneath the surface so you can judge correctly.'" And that's the difficulty we have, isn't it? Because when you lose the standard of Christianity, the standard of Christ, and you try and create laws to rule the world and to rule our society, you lose track of things. That's why there's courts. The courts are there no matter how many words we use to describe a law or describe a transgression of the law. There are hundreds and thousands and millions of arguments on how it's perceived and how it's to be understood and how it's to be, and people argue about that constantly. And so everything becomes shades of gray. There's no black and white anymore. And yet what he says is you got to look beneath the surface so you can judge correctly. You have to look at the spiritual side of the law, the spiritual side of yourself, the spiritual side of who you are. We are experts at hiding our spiritual side from everybody. I mean, if you really knew the real me, you wouldn't probably come here to listen to me. And of course, if I really knew the real you, I wouldn't be here with you either. But we are all sinful people. And as Christians, we're not above all that. We're just still sinners and who've been saved by grace. And so we can't think too much of ourselves, and yet we have to try to attain this higher standard. It's a difficult walk sometimes. In verse 25, it goes on to say, "Some of the people who lived in Jerusalem started to ask each other, 'Isn't this the man they are trying to kill? But here he is speaking in public, and they say nothing to him. Could our leaders possibly believe that he is the Messiah?'" And how interesting is that? Just before, the crowd is saying, "Who's trying to kill you? What are you talking about? There must be a demon in you." And yet now the crowd is saying, "Well, isn't he the guy that they're trying to kill?" You can see how society has double standards everywhere, and there's a double message. It's a difficult place to live. For we know that this man, but how could he be? For we know that this man comes from, where this man comes from. When the Messiah comes, he will simply appear. No one will know where he comes from. So because we know where this man comes from, he can't be the Messiah, because when the Messiah comes, nobody knows where he's going to come from. I mean, we use twisted logic sometimes to try and know what we believe instead of looking beneath the surface. While Jesus was teaching in the temple, he called out, "Yes, you know me, and you know where I come from. But I'm not here on my own. The one who sent me is true." And the word true is very important there, because the truth and the law is pretty much the same word. And you don't know him, but I know him because I come from him, and he sent me to you. Then the leaders tried to arrest him, but no one laid a hand on him because his time had not yet come. Again, we see that. His time had not yet come. He was here under God's purpose, under God's timing, and according to God's plan. The Jewish leaders were... When the Pharisees heard the crowds were whispering such things, they and the leading priests sent temple guards to arrest Jesus. But Jesus told them, "I will be with you only a little longer, then I will return to the one who sent me. You will search for me but not find me, and you cannot go where I am going." The Jewish leaders were puzzled by this statement. "Where is he planning to go?" they asked. "Is he thinking of leaving this country and going to the Jews in other lands? Maybe he will even teach the Greeks. What does he mean when he says, 'You will search for me but not find me, and you cannot go where I'm going'?" And it's interesting too, because earlier in the book of John, when Christ was teaching in the synagogue, and they approached him, and they said, "Well, here, why don't you do a miracle and show that you're God?" And he says, "You want to see a miracle? You destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will build it up again." And of course, he was talking about himself. In 3 days he would rise again, and they couldn't understand. They were thinking that he was talking about destroying the temple, and how foolish talk this was. They just didn't understand. But the interest, one of the things I like really about this passage is, here they are, they're celebrating the provision of God. And based on the Old Testament example from the time of Moses, when the people were surviving for 40 years wandering in the desert, and God provided, in the desert, God provided of all things the most important, water. And how miraculously he provided water. And he provided food through manna. All those things Moses didn't find. It wasn't the great hunter, it was God that provided all that for him. And this is what they were celebrating. And when you look at the book of John and the way Christ talked about himself being the I Am, he is the provider for all of our needs. And not, and yet, you know, these examples that they're celebrating were physical examples of our needs. And yet Christ was coming to show that, yeah, those physical examples are examples that represent the spiritual needs as well. And so he called himself the bread of life. One of the I Ams in I believe, chapter 3, he talks about him being the bread of life. Or I think it's, no, it's 6, I think, I'm sorry. But he talks about himself being the bread of life. And then he talks, and, when he, and then one of the things he did was he went to the Samaritan woman at the well, and he talked to her about living water, water that you would never thirst, would make you never thirsty again. And he talks about himself as being that provision. And that provision was physically represented by all of these feasts that they celebrated. And yet he continually talked to them about it, and they didn't understand. And here in verse 37, now it's the last day of this feast and the climax of the festival. Jesus stood and shouted to the crowds, "Anyone who is thirsty may come to me. Anyone who believes in me may come and drink. For the scriptures declare, rivers of living water will flow from his heart." When he said living water, he was speaking of the Spirit who would be given to everyone believing in him. But the Spirit had not yet been given, because Jesus had not yet entered into his glory. And now there was division and unbelief amongst many of them. When the crowds heard him say this, some of them declared, "Surely this man is the prophet we've been expecting." But yet others said, "He's the Messiah." And still others said, "But he can't be. Will a Messiah come from Galilee? For the scriptures clearly state that the Messiah will be born of royal line of David in Bethlehem, the village where King David was born." So the crowd was divided among him, divided about him, and some even wanted him arrested. but no one laid a hand on him. And it's so interesting how we cloud things up, how we can justify just about anything in our minds based on some simple facts, and we just make them into perceptions that are so unclear. And I find this part really interesting too, that when the temple guards, in verse 45, when the temple guards returned without having arrested Jesus, I imagine they should have been in big trouble, but the leading priests and Pharisees demanded, "Why didn't you bring him in?" And what did they say? The response was, "We've never heard anyone speak like this," the guards responded. And then what did they say? "Have you been led astray too?" the Pharisees mocked. "Is there a single one of us, rulers or Pharisees, who believes in him?" And there's the measure of truth. That's their measure of truth. If none of you believe in him, well then what's to believe, right? Why look at the truth? Don't look beneath the surface. Just look at the surface. We don't believe, therefore it can't be, right? And then he goes on to say, the foolish crowd follows him, but they're ignorant of the law. God's curse is on them. And yet here, Christ is teaching what the law fulfills. He's teaching the fulfillment of the law. And they're talking about him, the crowds being ignorant of the law because they're believing him. And then Nicodemus, the leader who had met with Jesus earlier, spoke up and he said, "Is it legal to convict a man before he's given a hearing?" I guess it was speaking somewhat in defense of Christ, but I'm not sure how brave that really was. But it was an attempt, and so we're not here to judge, but we're here to compare that to ourselves and the things that we do. And then they replied, "Are you from Galilee too? Search the scriptures and see for yourself. No prophet ever comes from Galilee." And then I just want to, and we only have 5 minutes left, but I just want to read quickly about the woman caught in adultery. Now this part this part of the scriptures wasn't in the originals, but it is here. And it talks about when the meeting broke up and everybody went home, and which is quite interesting. After this meeting broke up and everyone went home at the end of the feast, Christ didn't go home. He went and says in verse 1 and verse 8, in chapter 8, he returned to the Mount of Olives. And early the next morning, he was back again at the temple, and the crowd soon gathered, and he sat down and taught them. And he was speaking, and as he was speaking, the teachers of religious law and the Pharisees brought a woman who had been caught in the act of adultery. And they put her in front of the crowd, and I imagine they had her facing him. And they said, "Teacher, this woman was caught in the act of adultery. The law of Moses says to stone her. What do you say?" And they were trying to trap him into saying something they could use against him. But Jesus stooped down and wrote in the dust with his finger. They kept demanding an answer, so he stood up and again said, "All right, but let the one who has never sinned throw the first stone." Then he stooped down again and wrote in the dust. And when the accusers heard this, they slipped away one by one, beginning with the oldest, until only Jesus was left in the middle of the crowd with the woman. Then Jesus stood up again and said to the woman, "Where are your accusers? Didn't even one of them condemn you?" "No, Lord," she said. And Jesus said, "Neither do I. Go and sin no more." He didn't say go and try not to sin. He said go and sin no more. And I just see this picture as so real in what we live in today. Like when I, in my experiences at the university, when we used to have some serious spiritual arguments some with some of the people there, a lot of what they would say, like they would ask me for my defense against homosexuality, and I tell them that, you know, it's not the homosexual that I'm judging, it's the act that I'm judging. That's what, that act is sin, and it's the same sin as other sins that Christ and God has taught us not to do. But then you're immediately accused of being homophobic if you do that. So you're caught, you know, like damned if you do and damned if you don't. And that's pretty much what they tried to do with Christ here. They knew that there were conflicting laws. The Roman law was that the Jews could not take a life. They could not condemn a person to death. So he knew that if he said to go ahead and stone her, he would be breaking the Roman law. And yet the Jewish law was that if a woman was caught, if someone was caught in adultery, that they should be stoned. So he was stuck between two places, and what he did was absolutely amazing. And I often wonder, and many people have, because the scriptures don't tell us, what did he write down? What did he write? I don't know. Everybody's got an idea, I guess. But when I look at the context of this, now Christ represents himself as the prophet from the Old Testament, the one who was prophesied about, and the way the context is very clearly strung throughout, I often wonder, you know, because the last time a finger wrote anything was when Christ wrote the law on the tablets. And I wonder what he wrote down. Did he write down the laws that those people had sinned against themselves? And when he asked, okay, he was without sin, cast the first stone. Well, he could have, because he was. But he showed grace and truth. He showed it in balance. He showed the love of God, but he also said, don't sin anymore. And that's where we find ourselves today. And you know, I talked about living in the gray. And one of the reasons I appreciate this so much, it wasn't too long after we studied this that I was helping a friend of mine. He had to get his motorcycle taken to Canadian Tire, and I put it in a trailer behind my truck. And I was trying to maneuver in the Canadian Tire parking lot with this big truck and this trailer with the motorcycle on it. And he was trying to get in to talk to the mechanic to see where we could do it and all that stuff. And so, you know, it's like sometimes you get a little nervous and you're trying to move around. And I moved over to where the propane area was, thinking, well, if I parked in front of that, and you know, I wouldn't be in front of any parking spots. And if somebody came for propane, then I'd just simply move and find another spot. And I'm kind of nervous sitting there in this. I see this guy pull up, and he's got this big truck and big tires and four-wheeler and all that, and he's got the window open, and he's got his arm out, and there's tattoos on his arm, and he's smoking a cigarette, and I, like most people, I probably judged him. And he comes over and rolls his window down and talks to me, and I roll my window down, and he says, hey, he says, where'd you get that bush guard in front of your truck? And I said to him, well, I got it online, I don't know, I can't remember. He says, well, I really like it. Where'd you get it? And I said, well, I can't remember. You know, I'm busy here. Like, I can't remember. I don't know. And so he kind of huffed and moved away. And as soon as he did, I thought, you know, that was a lie. I might not remember exactly where I got it, but I could have given him a hint, you know. And I think what the danger for us who live in the gray area is that sometimes we get caught in sin because it's convenient for us. And we think that we're doing the right thing. And we're caught between what to do and what not to do. You know? And that's the time we have to remember to look to Christ, who is the example of grace and truth. He's the one that knows the balance. And of course, when we do get caught in a lie, we have to confess it immediately, and he's there to forgive us, thankfully. And we know that the father of lies is Satan, and he would love to see us get clouded into this gray area and lose our way. But I pray today that we will be refreshed and renewed, and that we will not lose our way, and that we will search below the surface in situations in our lives, in events in our lives, and in our personal lives, that we would see who we really are. And when we see the sin that's in us, or the evil that's in us, that we will confess it to the Lord, and that we will sin no more. Let's just bow in a word of prayer. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the word that teaches us, for the truth that reveals us, and for the love that saved us. Thank you for Jesus Christ and his example, Lord. Thank you for this standard that we have in front of us, this example that we have that we can strive to attain Help us, Lord, each to become like Jesus. Help us to strive to that end for the rest of our lives, so that when we see you in eternity, we can finish the race with love showing in our hearts for you, because we have endeavored, because we love you, and because you've loved us first. Thank you, dear Lord, for your laws, for your righteousness, and for your forgiveness. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.